And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight, we get to welcome back Michael Brown. And Michael Brown, as you may have remembered, we did a couple interviews with him before. The second one was actually on the Presence Process. We did his second book first. Then we had the Presence Process. And, well, Michael has revised the Presence Process. And so we're really excited to have you back and to talk about the changes and really to go over the book again, because it's really an amazing book. This time I was able to actually go through the entire process, the whole 10-week, and I have to say it's definitely life-changing, and you know, it's a really amazing work that you've been doing, Michael. So welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
So let's talk about first why you did revise your book.
Well, I think there were many, many reasons for that. One of them was that after I wrote it, I was asked by Namaste to go on a book tour or on a tour of doing presentations. And I spent a lot of time obviously explaining this work to people, and also doing one-on-one facilitations, and also answering loads of emails. And along that way, I gained many more insights about the work, and of course, different ways, more efficient ways of explaining it to people. So for a while, I had been asking the publisher if we could at some point, if I could at some point rewrite it to incorporate all of that. And in a way, I saw the first edition as almost a test run edition, and then the consequences of having published that and put that out, I wanted to incorporate what I'd learned as a consequence of that. Also, I noticed that because, you know, I'm explaining these things, the workings of the emotional body and the role it plays in our human experience for people, explaining during presentations, explaining during facilitations, that I was coming from a very mental place, and I am a very mental person. That's obviously why I'm so fascinated by the emotional realm. But I found that that the text could be less mental. It could trigger less mental activity in people if I could revise it. And you will notice in the new edition that it doesn't ask you to do too much mental activity at all. It doesn't ask you now to try and figure too much out. It's always pointing us back to the self aspect of our experience. Also, in the first edition, without intentionally doing so, the book kind of pointed people to what seemed to be a specific experience people are supposed to acquire, which wasn't my intent. But on re-going through the book, I saw that would happen to people who read it. And to me, what was important was that when someone enters something like the Presence Process, which is supposed to turn us into our own experience and help us to make our own experience the teaching, it was very important for me to communicate to people that the validity of their own experience. So in the new version of the book, you know, it constantly says that whatever you go through is valid. It's valid. It's not something you're supposed to be going through.
Right.
And then also, I love language, not necessarily from a literature point of view, but one of my favorite parts of writing that book and even doing the revised part is the editing. I guess, again, that's the mental part of me coming out, but I'm very particular about the words that I use. And so when I, and the way that I write, and I saw that in the first edition, as an example, I would say, you know, when one does this will happen. And when you say to somebody, this will happen, you're placing it in their future, not in the moment that they're in. And so you'll notice the text is very present moment text. In other words, this happens, not this will happen. And so it was all about looking at the way I was using language again, to keep people in the moment they were in and stop them from reading the text and then projecting the consequences into some future rather than allowing them to stay in the moment they're in. And I'm sure then, you know, and also you will notice that the presence activation statements became, for example, conscious responses. So I've changed some of the language, And the presence activation statements or the conscious responses, all of them were changed according to what felt more heart-based, less mental, and more efficient. And all, you know, there were large discussions that were in that book that when I went and revised it that I felt were just irrelevant or actually causing more mental disturbance. For example, I had a large discussion about the ego. But the ego is not really part of my vocabulary. I never really speak about the ego. So I took all of that out of the book. And it also gave me an opportunity to put in a few new pieces of writing. And also to include something, you know, like, because the presence process is about self-facilitation. But that can lead one to think that, you know, you're on your own, you need to rely only on yourself. And I introduced, for example, the notion of prayer into the book. You know, the idea of actually asking for assistance from whatever God is from you as part of your process. So it gave me an opportunity to really update things. And I'm completely happy now that the book stands, you know, as a completed piece now. And in fact, it's quite interesting talking to you about it now, because I haven't really looked at the book since I completed that editing process, which was in August last year. And I finished my part of the editing process, then I handed over to the Namaste editors. And even when they edited it, I didn't look at what they were doing. And what they did was, and they spent 6 months, they also transformed the way that I write, because they told me I like to write a novel in each sentence, which some people found when they were reading the first edition. And so David Ord in particular used his skill as an editor to put it into a language that was more accessible to everybody. And so the intent of the book was to make it more accessible to everybody. And I feel that we really accomplished that.
Yeah. I mean, it really is it's a wonderful journey to take yourself on, regardless of where you are on your own specific journey. I feel like I've done a lot of work, but, you know, it's amazing how, and that's probably it, I've done doing a lot of work. I mean, I'm always trying to do, fix, heal, work on, and... Yeah. And that is the whole point of this, is that, you know, it's not about the doing. It's really about the experiencing, the being, to get into that felt perception so that you can actually allow yourself to integrate. And that point was brought to us so many times in the book that it's in truly important. I mean, I really believe that that's the place we are in our evolution, that this is where we're headed. And I think, you know, we've done the therapies and, you know, I went to school for social work. I mean, we've done the counseling and the therapies and the way that has worked in the past. You know, there was a part where it's necessary. There's a part where our mind needs to understand certain things. But, you know, once you've understood it, and trust me, I've understood, you know, most of my issues for most of my life, doesn't mean that it helps you move through it. So, you know, this is really a helpful way to assist people to get out of their heads and move into their hearts, move into your body, get that more felt experience so you can understand and you can integrate.
And it's also transitional. So, you know, the presence process isn't in it of itself a path that people can now jump on and they're going to be doing the presence process over and over and over. That's not my intent in this. And I know that many people have done the presence process. You know, I've had emails from people saying, I'm on my 10th time.
Wow.
and I think to myself, you know, that's not what this book was written for, although that's your experience of it and that's the way you want to use it. But it's very transitional. You know, it's part of our journey, and for many people that have even done the presence process, it will deliver them to a place where even these mental understandings and even the idea of, okay, I'm going to feel this and heal it and almost like I know what to do, it will also deliver us to a place where even that is not even useful, of a place of greater surrender, where, you know, one may get to a place of saying, well, I can't really even integrate my own these emotional core issues anymore. I've done as much work as I can. I've participated in as much as I can in adjusting the quality or participating in the quality of my life experience. But there comes a point where I also have to stop and say, there's something greater that I now need to surrender to. And that's been my experience of it, you know, where I got to a point where even this work wasn't useful to me anymore. And I had to go to even a deeper level of work, which is even harder to vocalize, because it's not about understanding. So it is my hope that many people who do this work will move through it into even a deeper work, which only their heart can lead them into. And also what I noticed too is that, and what has changed in the revised edition is, I think many of us enter this type of work, whether we can admit it to ourselves or not, or aware that we're doing it or not, but we enter to get what we want. And so, you know, I have lots of emails saying, you know, I've been doing the presence process, but I still haven't met the right partner. I've been doing the presence process, but I'm still struggling with my abundance. I've done the presence process, and, you know, I'm still not happy in my marriage. And what a person is really saying is, this is not giving me what I want. Mm. And for example, when The Secret came out, The Secret was very attractive to people because it promised to give them what they want. You want a big house? Just think about it enough, you'll have a big house. You know, you want this? Just think about it enough, and you will have it. And for me, there's a much deeper level that we have to go through. You know, in my own experience, I came to understand that everything that I want for me personally, almost all of it, is driven by my emotional signatures. Mm. And the idea is that if I get what I want, then everything's going to be fine, and I'm going to feel much better about my life. And with the revised edition, you know, I emphasize the word requirement, because it's about what's required. And so our wants, which to me are very mental, but driven by emotional signatures, but they're a very mental idea of what we think is going to fix everything and make everything right. But our requirements is a very different, you know, what is required of us in this life? And can we surrender to that even if it's not what we want? And so the intent of the revised edition was to bring that into our awareness, that there is a greater world, and at some point we are going to be asked to surrender to whatever that is. And we'll know at what that point of surrender is, because we will be faced with things that no matter what we do, no matter how much we think, no matter how much we feel, no matter how many times we go through the presence process, we still can't change what's happening, because what's happening to us is required. And then it's a, you know, a different level of surrendering, or, you know, if you want to think of it in the terms of the presence process language, of responding to what's required, rather than trying to put our attention on what it is I personally want with this life.
Yeah, and you've mentioned some really great points. I mean, you know, clearly The Secret was to appeal to the masses, and, you know, to appeal to a more solar plexus type energy of, you know, greed and, you know, focusing on things. Yes, they tried to bring in some spiritual concepts, but most of it was really on, you know, getting the big house and getting the perfect partner and getting the $1 million. And that's really not what life's about.
Yes, but it was a very important step for many people, because it introduced them to the notion that they can participate in their experience.
Yes.
And I think that was a very big shift for people, and that's what the secret really was. You can participate, you
right.
know, but your participation doesn't mean you can have what you want. But there are many different ways that you can participate and impact the experience that you're having. So on that level, it came at a time where I think it was very important that people started to feel self-empowered on some level. And there are, and I've encountered many people who say the secret really transformed their lives. I've also met probably more people who said it just ended up frustrating them because it never gave them what they wanted. So if all it did is show us we can't have exactly what we want, but that there is a way we can participate, Then it definitely made a great contribution to the planet.
Absolutely. And that's the point. I mean, the point is, it's, we're on here because our soul is trying to expand and to grow, and we're only seeing the small pieces of us, you know, being in this individual life and thinking that we know everything about what we're supposed to be experiencing. But, you know, we don't. We don't know what our soul wants. We don't. I mean, we can sort of figure it out by some of the experiences we have and how we respond or react to them. But those are just the things that we are here to learn to accept about ourselves, our own individual being. I mean, it's an incredible experience right now, but it also can be very, what's the word that makes it sound better? it can be challenging. Sorry?
It's very challenging. And, you know, my feeling has been, because the presence process, yes, it came out of me interacting with a symptomatic condition that was painful and disturbing in my life, and that's what drove me into that. It also drove me into all sorts of explorations and experiencing ceremony. And you know, what I don't talk about the presence process is that it also came out of insights and intuitions and visions I had when I was in ceremony about what we are going to face as human beings. And I could see that I was going to face events and changes of circumstances in my lifetime that were going to completely change the entire way I perceive myself as a human being, how we perceive what's going on this planet, all of these things. And so the presence process also came out of having these intuitions and visions and the engagement I had through ceremony with elders and about the events and the change of circumstances, which now anyone who doesn't look across the planet now and see that we are in a drought, in a stage, no one really knows what's happening, but we all know we're on an event horizon, and this event horizon is bringing us a complete change in the human circumstance. And so my feeling is that many people who are doing the presence process now, and we of course come to it like I did, the sort of work of, I don't want any more pain. I want a more abundant lifestyle. You know, I want to be a more successful person or a more spiritual, whatever these things are that we want. And so those things drive us into looking at things or exploring experiences like this. But my feeling is that over the next few years, people who have done the presence process and to try and, you know, impact their personal life experiences or their relationships with other people, are going to find the principles of this technology, because the presence process is a kind of technology. So they're going to find the principles of this technology very useful when we are faced with certain vast changes of circumstances which are happening on our planet. And as those circumstances unfold before us, we have a choice of whether we are going to respond to them or react to them as if we're going to behave as if it's not supposed to be happening, or it is supposed to be happening. This is the role of what's unfolding, and how do I respond and participate in it? And the outcomes are very different. The consequences are very different when someone is faced with a circumstance and they declare to themselves and their consciousness it's not supposed to be happening, something else is supposed to be happening. Or we look at it and we say, how can I respond to this? How can I transform myself through this experience? And so I feel that the presence process is going to mean something different to people over the next few years than it has meant up to this point.
Well, that's well said. And I know that every new year you put out a New Year's message, and I actually love reading them because they're usually filled with some very interesting things to think about, things to experience, things to, you know, help you on the journey. So I definitely recommend that people go to your website and sign up on your website so that you can get that. But so, I mean, that's really what it's about, though. I mean, we are in such a rapid change and rapid experiences that we really do have to find our way, whatever that is, to being fully in our body.
Yes, and these circumstances are necessary because human beings, you know, we're kind of a lazy tribe, and we won't change if everything's good. You know, we won't change. If everything's going great, we kind of settle in on the couch and you know, continue our life comfortably and no changes. And most of us will only make important changes within our, in the way we're interacting with our lifestyle if our circumstances change. And so, you know, part of that journey of the evolution of the human experience is we're going to be faced with circumstances, and those circumstances are the trigger points for these changes. So for me, it's a very necessary part of our journey that we're in now, where circumstances are changing at such a rate, and events are happening at an escalating rate, that we now have to see something bigger is going on, and what is our part in this, and how do we see ourselves moving through it, and how do we see ourselves coming to the other side of it, and what is it that needs to be transformed within us, and within our relationships with people around us and with the world around us, so that we can move through this experience and come out on the other side, having evolved through it. So for me, that is also, you know, a very important part of it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and it, you know, part of the process, part of the presence process, is certainly about conscious breathing, and you know, that conscious breathing is definitely a way for people to get into their body, and I mean, that's what it is. It's finding that way so that we're not in our heads, we're not projecting into the future, or we're not, you know, reflecting in the past, but that we're in this moment right now, fully present.
Yes.
Which is hard for a lot of people.
And once we tune into the self aspects of the experience, you know, then the conscious breathing part of the tool falls away. It's like, you know, when a rocket's blasted into space, it has, you know, aspects to the rocket that it uses to blast into space. And once it's used those parts, it actually ejects them off the rocket because it's no longer needed. So it's useful to a certain point, and then it's no longer required. And you know, I feel that way about the whole presence process.
Okay.
You know, even in my experience of it, I don't even think about the presence process anymore. I don't think about it anymore, and that's why I'm kind of I wonder when I'm going to do an interview like this, what it's going to be like, because I don't think about that stuff anymore. Now it's very simple for me. In that I rely on the self aspect of my experience to guide me, and I know that when something happens in my life that is strange or unfamiliar or uncomfortable, or you know, running into a wall or sudden unconscious or a shadow behavior coming up, that yes, it will impact me physically and there will be an evidence of it there. Yes, I'll have all thoughts and ideas about it, but I know that if I as efficiently as possible take myself to the felt aspect of it, and honor that as being valid and allow myself to feel that the consequence of that is going to lead me through the experience, give me the insight, and enable me to transform the way I'm physically interacting with it. So I trust the felt aspect of the experience. But then, you know, there's even a deeper level, as I was saying before, where sometimes even just feeling it is still me trying to in some way control it or know what's going on. And there's also a point where of just complete surrender and say, well, I can't do anything. I don't know anything about it. I don't understand it. I'm not going to figure it out. Here, I offer it up as it is and help me out, you know. So to take me to a point of surrender. But I think it's very important we first go through those steps. For example, in my own journey, which brought me into the presence process of extreme physical pain, I went through those levels where I first tried to physically do something about my experience. Then I tried to mentally understand my experience. And then I tried to go into feeling it and doing all of that, the thought aspects of my experience. And then I got to a point where I just surrendered that part of the experience. And it's really in the surrender that everything takes place. And I think for us as human beings, we're going to reach places of surrender, because when we reach the place of surrender, the only thing that's left that's going on is being. There is no doing left anymore. There's no mental doing, there's no physical doing about it. There's not even the doing of the self-perception, what am I feeling. Even that will become surrendered. And now I'm just going to be with the experience. And this is, I think, a very important part of our journey, because it's going to reestablish beingness as the causality of everything, and doingness as the consequence of beingness, as an expression of beingness. The reestablishment of the value of beingness is what I see as part of the next level of our journey. And self-perception delivers us, you know, to that place. We, even in the text, we say, be with it without condition. And, you know, our mental side will go to the without condition. How do I do the without condition? But the word is be, you know, be with it without condition. And it's that we are becoming now human beings. That's our destiny, to become human beings. And so part of the journey is to be faced with circumstances and events that we can do nothing about, and so that we can surrender and just be in them and reawaken to the value of being as causal to everything.
And, I mean, you talk about this a fair bit in the book, that, you know, mostly we're trying to control and manipulate everything around us. We're not surrendering, we're not being, but we're trying to, you know, manipulate. And as it goes deeper into it, we're really trying to manipulate and control things because we want to be loved and accepted for who we are, except we always feel there's these conditions. So we put the conditions on ourselves, then we try and control everything around us, and that's the drama that we kind of play into.
Right, right. And but it's everywhere around us. You know, we live in a world, you know, that where everything around us is saying, you know, especially the media is saying, the way you are now isn't the way you should be. Here's another way. You can look more beautiful. You can be more successful. You can get a product that does things better. Your, you know, even the cell phone you have isn't the right one. You need to have a different one. And so it's a continual invalidation of the experience we're in now. And many of our religions will also do that. You know, on a very deep level, some of our biggest religions on the planet even dismiss our experience of the planet. It's a sort of a transient experience. This life is not the important one.
Right.
What's going to happen when it's finished, so that's important. So you know, prepare yourself and get yourself straight for that, right? So we're continually unconsciously invalidating our own experience. To me, the portal, you know, the great portal that I discovered for my own experience was that no matter what was going on in my life, is to validate it. No matter how horrible it is, you know, no matter how scary it might be, no matter how angry I might be in it, but to validate the experience and say, well, this is what's going on, and I need to validate this and appreciate this in order for anything else to truly evolve out of it. I need to appreciate it. So, for example, you know, people might be living where they don't want to live and think, if I lived somewhere else, then everything would be better. But it's actually in appreciating where we are that, you know, that anything truly comes out of it. If we go away from where we are and to another place to try and make it better, whatever it is that we were unable to appreciate about the experience we were in will again re-manifest. And so it's really about, you know, coming into the experience we're in and really appreciating why I'm here, why is this required for me at the moment, how can I respond to it. And it's through that portal, to me, that the evolutionary movement comes out of.
Yeah, okay. And can you talk about, because I think it's an important aspect of what we're going through, but time, how time is sort of what catches us up.
Well, I don't even know how to think about that. You know, for me, time it's not so much time. It's never been about time as a watch that we wear on our hand. And that was never really how I engaged with time in the work of the presence process. The way I engaged with time was, you know, events of the past, particularly in our childhood, that remained unintegrated, that were now rearing their heads in this moment that we're in. So, in other words, emotional time. A piece of time from the past, and we use the word symptom, some time, a piece of time or an experience from our childhood, for example, that is unintegrated, that is hard for us to digest, that is now showing up in this moment that I'm in and causing me to experience reactive behavior or addictive behavior or whatever that behavior is causing me to experience in this moment. And in that relation, then that piece of time is impacting me now. And what it's really doing is pulling on my attention to go back. If it's not really back, you know, in the text, we don't talk about going back, we talk about going in, because the past is within us, it's not behind us. So something is pulling us to that moment that was unintegrated. So it's really about emotional time. And that's the way I look at time. I know there's many ways of looking at time, but I don't also look at it too much as a linear event, you know, that it's a long line that we are moving along. I kind of look at it differently, but the emotional time is what we're dealing with in this work.
Right, okay. And how our life is sort of set up. Every experience seems to be a setup, because we're all moving towards this experience of being, and because we've not been allowed to talk about the fact that we, you know, our emotions, we weren't able to integrate them because of our life, the way we have certain stages. So everything's sort of set up for us to allow us to integrate at this time versus when we were a child.
You know, my comprehension of integration, although we focus on the emotional aspect of it as being causal in this work, integration requires a, you know, and many people who might get into this work might say, well, then I don't need to do that physical stuff, or I shouldn't do the mental stuff, because I must only do the emotional stuff. The emotional stuff is causal in this work, but in order to integrate any experience requires a physical, mental, emotional, and vibrational experience. And so for us during childhood, for example, if I go through a childhood experience, say at the age of 5, where something traumatic happens around me, I don't really understand the physical aspects of it. Say, for example, it's a divorce. A 5-year-old child doesn't understand the physical parameters of what divorce is about. Nor do they mentally have a framework for this word divorce and the events around it. And what's happening to the child is, yes, there's physical circumstances happening around them, there's things that people are saying around them, but on a level, the child's level, they're being impacted very deeply by the felt aspect of the experience. So it's impacting the emotional body in a way that is determining how the emotional body works. And some of the experiences impacting the emotional body are indigestible. And one of the insights that I had about it was, they're not digestible because we don't have the mental parameters and the physical parameters intact. We've still got to develop ourselves mentally. We've still got to go out and have physical experiences in the world that will enable us to know what this divorce experience is and what it was about. And so only when we get to a certain level of our development, and that's why I've never encouraged anyone to do this work under the age of 18 or even under the age of 16, although I'm sure there are kids today that can do this sort of thing, but When I did one-on-one facilitation, the youngest person I facilitated, if I recall, I think was about 14 years old, one of these sort of indigo children, mm-hmm. who was very advanced in their perception of the world, and I could have a conversation, a totally candid conversation with them about this work and not have to speak in a language that I thought would be better for them to understand. And, you know, we did a lot of one-on-one facilitation. They went through a 10-week process with me. And where I found where they were lacking, although they had sort of good mental grasp, and where they were lacking is they didn't have the physical life experiences to help them to integrate the experience that they were going through. So the emotional stuff of our childhood, a child doesn't integrate them because they don't yet have the mental constructs that are required and also the physical constructs. Because integration means that the whole part of our experience is involved in that process. It's not just, you know, when we go through emotional integration, for example, when I feel without condition and I get in touch with my emotional component and I allow that energy which has been blocked to start moving, as a consequence of it moving, there's going to be mental consequences happening simultaneously, as well as physical consequences happening simultaneously. So when we integrate, you know, and as well when we receive deep insights about what this means for our life purpose and all these sorts of things, those are more the vibrational integrations happening. All these things are happening simultaneously, and they are all important. So the physical, mental, and emotional aspects and the vibrational all participate in the integration, in bringing back to wholeness what is being separated or fragmented in our awareness. So although in this process we're focusing on the emotional as the causality, it doesn't eliminate the physical and mental aspects of the experience. These are participating and as important. But what the emphasis has been in this work is that if you're going through an experience that's indigestible, it is very important to do physical things, like if you had for example, when I had a lot of pain, I still went and did physical things like got a massage and took care of my body. You know, I still did mental things like when I got into very deep, dark, negative thought patterns, to become aware of it and to choose not to entertain those thought patterns. So there's still mental things going on. But the mental and the physical work is not going to come into play successfully unless the emotional component is there. Mm-hmm. And an example of that, for example, is we can go to the abundance. You know, I can walk around, if I can look at my life and say, you know, I have abundance issues, and so I'm going to sort them out by saying, I'm abundant. I can just go at it mentally and walk around chanting a mantra like that. But that won't assist me to integrate what's going on, because I'm doing the mental and I may do the physical of working harder and taking every opportunity and networking with people and trying to organize my balance that way. But if I don't go to the core causality, what is the felt aspect of the emotional condition I experience as a child that is actually impacting my capacity to receive from the unlimited abundance of the universe what I require? So doing the physical and mental things are important, but it's very important that we focus on the emotional as causal.
Yes, perfect. Okay, so let's talk about the one thing that would save so many people so much heartache and so much anger and so much pain, which is, you know, seeing the messengers and getting the message instead of thinking that it is the people.
Yeah. Well, you know, that comes from our being, you know, from our being physically transfixed on the world as being the causality of our experience, and that the world is something that happens to us. And also it comes from the fact of not having developed the level of self-perception or having shut it down and sedated and controlled it, so we cannot see the causality of what's happening to us. I cannot feel the causal point, which is what's going on in my emotional body. And so I'm looking outward at the world, and so when my emotional conditions arise to the surface, for me to integrate, to give me an opportunity to integrate them. If I'm very physically transfixed about the world, then I will perceive it as people doing things to me. And if I change what they're doing or the way that I'm relating to them, push them out of my environment, break up with that person, move my job, that will make the changes. And that's focusing very much on the physical. Or I can focus on the mental. We did a lot of mental focus many years ago in which affirmations were a great thing. And if I can just control my thinking, then I'm going to change what's happening to me. So what this work is pointing out is that while we don't have insights, while we haven't developed the level of self-perception that enables us to perceive the causality of what's happening to us, which is internal, we tend to look outside instead of inside. We look outside. And what's very hard, and even to this day, I am challenged by it because I'm in the human experience just like all of us. And so I will still get upset by things. Things will happen and they will upset me. And it will appear as if the world is doing something to me. But in every instance, when I allow myself to look at the physical event as being a mirror, and the mental event, the story of telling myself as a way of leading myself from that outer event towards myself, to tell myself the story of what I think is happening to me, the intent of telling the story is to bring into my awareness the felt aspect of the experience. And that what's happening is we're living on a planet at the moment that has just got hordes of messengers dashing around, whether it's economic messengers, whether it's environmental messengers, whether it's political messengers, religious messengers, things that are happening in the world that appear to be happening to us as human beings, to me, are all outer manifestations of the inner condition of our humanity that we're now being asked to look at from a much deeper level. And the tendency is to try and change it physically or to engage with it reactively and mentally. For example, to say to somebody, let's sit down and talk about this. And if we talk about this, we can figure it out. But there's a deeper level we're being asked to go to in ourselves and look and see, well, this event that's going on in my environment, although it looks like it's a new event, if I look within myself and see the self aspect that it's bringing up into my experience and how it's making me feel, and I ask myself, is this feeling familiar to me? Have I not felt this before? I'll discover that all through my life, events have happened that have brought this particular feeling up in me. They've all been these messenger events. And so setup, even the word setup can lead us to feel like we're being sabotaged, but it's not really a setup in that way. It's just being brought to us on the outside, because that's where our perception at the moment is located. It's located upon the outer world. So if we need to know something that's really important to us that we need to work with, we're going to perceive it in the outer world, because that's where we're looking. The inner world for many of us is not a reality yet. And to perceive the causal point of that upsetting moment requires looking at the physical event, seeing the story we attach to it, realizing it's just a story, it's an explanation that we tell ourselves based on our belief systems, etc., etc. But underlying that, there's always a felt aspect which is always there, and getting in out. And so the outer event is a mirror for the inner self experience that we've been called upon to integrate.
We lost you for a little bit there, but I think we picked up mostly what you said. We do get caught up in the stories, and we do get caught up in the people, and it is an interesting aspect that we need to try and remember. But I mean, a lot of what we talk about is that mostly we're in resistance. Mostly we're resisting our pain and trying to cover it up by using drugs or numbing ourselves or distracting ourselves or trying to control and sedate things. And I think that that's, our way, well, you explain it, because it, it's it seems that that's the thing we do the most instead of being. We try and do these things.
Well, you know, if you go to a, for example, if you go to a physician, a physical doctor,
right?
If you go to a doctor, it's very unlikely you're going to go to a doctor in this world and say and be diagnosed. For example, if you go and you're diagnosed with cancer, it's very unlikely the doctor's going to say to you, "This is supposed to be happening." Relax, this is supposed to be happening, now let's respond to it. You know, it's very unlikely that you're going to get that interaction with most physicians in the world, for example. So it's very unlikely that you're going to go to people in the world. If you have a traumatic, for example, this in my family, there's just been 2 days ago there was a death in my family. It's very, no one around me said this is supposed to happen, right? They all say this have happened. Why did this happen? And for me, I see when I look at the events leading up to that particular transition of the person, I can see how divinely it was orchestrated. How everything was set up in the most beautiful way for everyone around, if they could just look and see that this was supposed to happen, right? So it's very hard for us to look at our life experience and say, this is supposed to happen. And that's why I was bringing up the word required.
Right.
Yes, a death in the family is not what anyone wants.
No.
But when it happens, you know, for me, a definition of required is if it happens, it's required. If something happens in my life, and there's nothing I can do to stop it, and it just happened regardless of all my, then it's required. Then let me respond to that. And instead of trying to manipulate my experience and invalidate and say, this is not supposed to be happening. Right. So, for example, we can look on a larger scale. The crashing of the economies, all these millions of people out of work can't find jobs. No matter what they do, they cannot help themselves. It doesn't matter how many applications they put in. Many people can't even find a place to apply because there's nothing to apply for. In other words, this is required. So a more important question to ask is, why is this required of us at the moment? Yes, I do want to have my job back. Yes, I do want to have my income the way it was. But I can't. So why is this happening? What am I being asked to look at? What are we being asked to look at as human beings? You know, the earth movements that are happening, the changes on the planet, we can't stop these changes. They are required. So, you know, to me, and that's why I'm saying that something like a presence practice is going to have a very different meaning down the line to what it does now. Because it shows us how to engage with what's required. And in our own experience, if I get upset, if someone comes to my front door or I engage with someone in the street and they say something that's really hurtful to me, I will feel hurt. I will be upset because I'm human. I'm going to have a human interaction. And if I'm hurt and upset, it's because there's something unintegrated in me that was brought into my awareness in that moment. But that encounter with that person, that's required, that's a gift. And so until I can respond to my life in that way, then I'm stuck because I'm continually in a state of saying, my life is not supposed to be happening. According to my educators, according to my politicians, according to my priesthood, according to my family, my life is supposed to be another way than it is. And until I get it that way, you know, I'm not going to be a happy person. So it's very unlikely we are going to get the world to validate that what's happening to us is required. The only way that that becomes validated is if I engage with my experience from that level. So, for example, that confrontation I had with someone in the street. When I go and I look at the emotional signature related to that, and I go and digest that, and I see I move that energy within me starts to move again that was blocked, and maybe I'll go through some sort of emotional release, and then I'll learn to contain the experience. Whatever I go through and I receive insights about my life through it, then I can see that that person coming up to me in the street was required. It was required because I received such a blessing out of it. But the blessing doesn't come if I invalidate the experience. The blessing for humanity at the moment does not come to us by invalidating our human experience, by saying we want the way it was, We want things to be back the way they were. We want to fix everything and put it back together the way it was. That's not going to assist us. What's going to assist us as human beings is to look out at the world and the way things are unfolding and saying, this is required, and how do I respond to this on my own, and respond and participate in my own level. And on that life, on that level, so much of our life is all these messengers and these setups that are coming towards us. And this experience of humanity is going through at the moment is a big setup, because we as human beings cannot continue on the trajectory that we're on. It's actually an impossibility for us to even survive as a species if we continue on the trajectory that we're on. And so something is required of us now to make a change. And those requirements are going to make themselves known to us as events that don't allow us to have what we want to have anymore. Whether it's the way we earned our income, or the place we used to live, or the climate we used to have, all of these things. I write about it in that article, The Revelation of Being, is awakening to being a human being comes through being faced with things we can do absolutely nothing about. And at some point we surrender and then be with it, and then we start to awaken to being as the causality of our experience, and that's where we have to surrender to our beingness as being the causality of the human experience. And when we surrender to that, the nature of the experience we turn up expressing isn't one that destroys everything around us, manipulates everything around us, and turns us into very separated, selfish beings.
Wow, that was very powerful. Thank you. Let's talk about how we seem to want to seek peace, but we need to make it. And you talk about forgiveness being...
Yes. Yes. Well, you see, the world, very unlikely we'll discover what peace is by looking at the world and by listening to the world, especially to the peacemakers of the world. We go around having these big conferences, and the Middle East is always the absolute prime example of what peace is not. And the Middle East peace process is an example of what a peace process, of what attaining peace is not about. In fact, they should change it from being the Middle East peace process to the Middle East power process, right? Yeah. Because really what people are fighting about is they want power, whether it's one group wanting to have the power over their own autonomy, or the other group wanting to have power over them. And that's because we're not even aware of what peace is. And very, very few people are showing people what peace is. And peace isn't something that, and also peace is personal, so we can't get together in a group and make some peaceful event happen. That's also a delusion, and the idea of making peace something that we have to create circumstances, which we'll see most of us in this world, when we think about peace, we think it's a circumstance that we have to make. And we will approach it either by physically rearranging our circumstances, doing things physically to make peace, or doing it mentally, like discussing, having a conference. You bring your ideas, I'll bring my ideas, we'll have a certain compromise, and once we've compromised, then there will be peace. And all that really is a sedation and control of human behavior to the point that people are so sedated and controlled it looks peaceful, but actually it's sedation and control. And peace is really just a self-experience. Peace, we say I feel peace. And anyone who wants to realize an awareness of peace can do so right now. We can just ask certain questions. We can sit quietly with our eyes closed and ask, where is the stillness? Where is the silence? Where is the emptiness? Those kinds of questions, especially those two, stillness, silence, emptiness. And if we just sit exactly where we are right now and ask, where is the stillness? And feel it. Where is the silence? And feel that. Where is the emptiness? That's where the peace is. It's a felt experience. It's always here. The entire planet is enveloped with peace. And for example, I used to use the example of war to demonstrate what peace was, but I also recently had this picture come to me of, you can imagine someone walking through a children's playground during recess. The children are running and screaming, and they might say to themselves, you can't keep peace around here with all this running and screaming and shouting. And then the recess bell rings and all the children go back into school and the playground becomes empty and it's quiet and it's peaceful. But what doesn't mean that the peace has suddenly arrived. It means that what was obscuring the peace for that person has now been removed. But the peace is always there. So it's not really a case of making peace for ourselves. It's really finding out what is it about our experience that's obscuring the peace that's already in us, that's already available to every human being, because it's part of our birthright. We are blessed by a planet that's completely peaceful. And in most cases, if you remove humans from any region, you'll see how peaceful that region is. It's not because there wasn't peace in that region before. It's because of the human activity and our involvement in it caused us to lose an awareness of what peace is. And one of the rarest probably activities going on the planet at the moment are people that are voluntarily feeling peaceful no matter what's going on around them. In other words, being aware of that inner silence, stillness, the sense of space within us. When we close our eyes, we just close our eyes and sit quietly. Within 15 or 20 minutes when the body settles a bit, we will become aware of spaciousness and there's a silence all around us. There's a stillness all around us, even though the world is moving and everything's moving. And in that is the peace, and it's always with us. And for example, in the Middle East, there is going to never, ever be peace there until individuals interact with peace on their own accord. And also, peace isn't given through compromise and through agreement. So even if, for example, in the case of the Middle East, even if the Palestinians got exactly what they wanted, everything that they wanted, they still wouldn't be peaceful if they were not peaceful to start with, if they were not aware of what peace is to start with. If the Israelis get exactly what they want the way they want it, they're still not going to be peaceful people because they're still not aware of what peace really is. And peace is available to everybody no matter what circumstances they're in, because it's something that's within us that has to be felt personally. And the only people that should really be involved in any peace process are people who already in themselves are peaceful. So they already are seeing, and what they're speaking from is a point of peace, not from a point of conflict trying to gain peace. In themselves, they speak from a point of peace. And that's, you know, what that saying is, go in peace. If we engage with any experience, the causal point of the experience is the outcome. Always, the causal point is the outcome. So if I enter an interaction with somebody and I'm angry with them and I think that, then the outcome is going to be anger. If I go to war to make peace, I'm going to war out of anger. I'm going to war out of peace. If I go to war out of anger, then all I'm going to do is sow more and more seeds of anger. So until people are, and there are people sitting in that region, in the Middle East region, who are not involved in the peace process at all, but who are themselves anchoring and a self-awareness of peace within themselves. Those are the peace feelers. Those are the ones that are remembering peace on the planet. Yes. And it's one of the most scarcest commodities. It's not that it's a scarce commodity, but one of the rarest things possibly going on the planet is an individual sitting within themselves or being active in their lives and remembering to feel peaceful as they do so, because the consequence of that behavior, of any activity, when it comes out of a feeling of peacefulness, is going to be a greater awareness of peace around that individual. So the peacemakers are not really peacemakers, they're really power brokers. And you know, it's ridiculous. For example, the Nobel Peace Prize. There's probably very few people who've received the Nobel Peace Prize who themselves are peaceful and actually know what peace is. They may have received the Peace Prize for rearranging human circumstances, but actually, I'm sure I have I would love to ask the people on the Nobel Committee who decide on the Nobel Peace Prize, I would love to ask them what peace is, and I wonder actually if they know what peace is within themselves, or if they still believe it's some physical, some outer event or circumstance that has to be put in place so that we can have a certain human behavior which to them now equals peacefulness, you know, being at peace. But peace is a self experience, and it's also, it's not a group activity. Peace is personal. And peace, you know, we can't be right and have peace. Peace is available whether we're right or not. You know, so it doesn't require compromises. It doesn't, you know, peace is there, here, in this moment where we are all the time. It's our choice whether we want to feel it. It's completely a choice. Peace is a choice. It's a choice to engage a certain level of self-capacity, a self-capacity that is calm and quiet and still within us, no matter the activity around us. And when we engage that, the consequences of all our behaviors and activities it radiates that awareness into those around us. But if we don't already have that awareness within us, no amount of talking about peace or doing things to make peace happen, all these things are actually just interference and will themselves, because the causality is always the outcome. Whenever I go to war to create peace, I just create more war. Whenever I go to, whenever I engage in mental activity to try and create peace, I'm just going to cause more mental activity. But if I sit in a meeting with people about peace and I myself engage in the felt aspect of peace while I'm in that meeting and say in that felt resonance of peace, remember what peace really is, then I'm going to have a beneficial impact on that experience around me. In other words, the awareness of what peace is will surface more easily in people around me. But it definitely doesn't have to be made. Peace is part of our what's created. It's always here. It will be here long after the human species, and it was here long before the human species arrived. And that's what peace is authentically. And when we realize that, we realize that there's nobody that can give it to us. It's something that we choose for ourselves. And it's a very challenging choice, because it's very challenging to choose to be in a peaceful resonance when around us is asking everything else of us, you know, to be angry, to be confrontational, to be dissatisfied, but to actually remain in that peace. You know, and so as I said earlier on, that was that saying, go in peace, means wherever you go, remember what peace is and feel that quiet peacefulness inside yourself, that still, empty, silent, peaceful resonance that is within us, and permeates this entire planet, and feel it as we move about the world. Those are the ones that are anchoring the awareness of what peace is along the planet, which is it's very rare at the moment, because we're all being faced with such circumstances that are causing us to addictively go into reactive behavior. And peace is not a reaction. You know, feeling peace is not a reaction to anything. It's a response to something.
Wow, Michael. This has been a very interesting interview. I really appreciate it. I'd love to ask one last thing about appreciation, just because that seems to be a nice way to end the interview, and how, you know, our purpose is to love and appreciate what we already are without the conditions.
It's very, it's very challenging, because, being told that we're supposed to be another way, it's hard to appreciate the way that we really are in any moment. But appreciation for me is a sort of two-sided word. If I say I appreciate you, it means I like you and I'm thankful for you. But also when stocks and shares appreciate, it means they become more. And so appreciation is about, if I appreciate peace, we were talking about peace. To appreciate peace means to put my attention on it and to appreciate it. Because the more I put my attention on the self-resonance of peace in me, the more of it is going to enter my experience and radiate around me. I will only accomplish a peaceful life if I appreciate peace. So in that term, to appreciate something in the context of the work of the presence process, is to be thankful for something in such a way that it makes more of it. It increases it in our human experience.
Lovely. Again, Michael, thank you very much. This has been a wonderful interview. I greatly enjoyed your concepts and everything that you brought to this, some of it in the book, some of it not in the book, and I definitely recommend for anybody who has not read The Presence Process to definitely get that. Michael, do you still have your website, thepresenceportal.com? Is that still the way people should get a hold of you?
Yes, it's still up and running. I'm not that involved. I haven't, you know, I stopped writing in about June. I've written, I think, one article since then. So I'm not that involved in it, but I'm still receiving emails.
Okay.
The website is still up and running, and it's still a wonderfully useful resource center for anyone looking at the emotional aspect of their lives and the role that emotions play in the quality of their ongoing experience.
Perfect. All right. Well, I don't know what's in store for you next, but I'm here whenever you...
Well, if you do know, let me know. Right,
you're great. Okay, well, thank you again, Michael.
Well, thank you. It's been great chatting to you, Laurie.
All right.